4:45. We are recording sperm whales, which we just passed this morning. Ship is probably now about a half mile away. We have an expendable sonoboy, number channel 28. The Nagra set on plus 30.
I grew up seeing the bumper stickers that said "Save the Whale" on cars going by, and Australia was very proactive in its involvement in advocating for the preservation of whales. So there are many more whales in the sea than there once were. But at the same time, the world in which those whales live is a 21st century world. It's a world where the ocean is more full of plastic, slightly more acidic because of carbon dioxide absorption as a result of climate change. It's a world in which the temperature of the ocean is changing. It's a world in which noise pollution in the ocean is becoming more and more of a significant problem, particularly for an animal that lives in such delicate acoustic relationship to one another and to physical features of the sea and to prey identification. So the world of the whale has changed.
Standing still. There's a ship a couple miles away, right in line now. The bearings, right? Mine's got a bow aspect, so it's a little difficult to hear. Since this recording, there's been two or three that have surfaced about 5 miles distance while we've held these one or two by sound. It's night listening here. Going up the coast towards San Juan.
Stories about whales, and particularly stories about being consumed by whales, populate everything from the tall tales of old salt fishermen to biblical stories. They get iterated in science fiction. You can read them in authors as varied as Anais Nin, all the way through to Thomas Hobbes. So we have a sense that there is a kind of intimacy in our storytelling with whale kind. So up the stairs and in the mouth, that's the way we get in?
Yes, there I am. We are now sitting inside the Malmskavalen, and so this Malm blue whale, actually, that was stranded just south of Gothenburg in 1865. And this was a young male, 1.5 or 2 years old, but still 16 meters long. At this time, there were still a lot of blue whales in North Atlantic, but it was very rare in Sweden indeed, because they didn't start hunting for blue whales until 20, 30 years later in the end of the 19th century, when the ships was fast enough.
When you first look at the image on the title page of Leviathan, you can see a city or a town surrounded by fields and smaller villages, and then looming over the horizon is a great figure. You can see the head of a man with a crown, long hair and a moustache, looking like a 17th century man. And then in the hands of this colossus, there's the symbol of the sword in one hand and the bishop's crozier in the other, the symbols of both ecclesiastical and civil power. But his body, on closer inspection, is composed of a multitude of figures. These are men and women looking up at him, composing his arms and his torso. And this is, if you like, the twist in the tale, because there's this great source of power that inspires awe and fear in the subjects, in the citizens, and yet they compose it. They are the matter of which this colossus is made. It's their opinion of him as a powerful, fearful source of authority that actually keeps this state, this commonwealth, this body politic together. And Hobbes would describe this great Leviathan as a mortal god. There's nothing on earth like him.
Thank you.
the first reaction they had when they saw this blue whale that was still alive, actually, on a rock outside on the beach here, that one, kill it. So there was two guys who claimed the ownership of it, and they tried to kill it with knives and a stake in the eye, kind of messy and bloody and gory. Actually, they told the museum, and August Malm, the museum curator, saw this wonderful opportunity, so he bought the rights for it. So they managed to drag it with tugboats to a shipyard in Gothenburg, and then he hired a bunch of butcher apprentices that they should peel off the skin piece by piece, remove the blubber, then they remove all the flesh. Malm, actually, it was a man who knew to take care of opportunities, so he shared a little fee to come get close to the blue whale, and he also had some of the flesh, some piece of flesh that they cut and roasted on a fire that you can try, taste it. But what is very special with this is the only mounted one actually we know of in the world. And at this time, 1860s, they have just discovered the dinosaurs, and they also had these big models of dinosaurs. Some of them had an open space, like you can have a dinner table within this big model of a dinosaur. This odd idea, maybe I think in the Victorian era you had this clash between this culture having dinner with wonderful ladies and men with tuxedos or something like that. The culture against the raw nature, that was the idea. And those guys, okay, we make a chamber inside this whale so you can open the jaw. The upper jaw actually is hinged. That's completely different from what you have in nature. And it takes 20 minutes like to slowly raise the upper jaw. When you got it high enough, then you got two supporting rods. Then you need staircases to be able to safely go up. So when I'm sitting here, there's a kind of a blue, like silk tapestry, like you were in kind of an old-style cellar in some kind of medieval castle or something. Light blue with some white stars. They made it look like a very human, comfortable room where you like you sit on the benches and you talk. Maybe you can drink coffee in here and have some champagne.
Thank you. several decades ago, there were enough blue whales in existence so that a large part of the whaler's catch was blue whale. But today, there are so few of these wondrous creatures left that we can't be positive that they are safe from extinction. The few that are left are far-ranging and use all oceans. We hope that through protection, their numbers will increase again so that we can all enjoy them and find answers for the many mysteries that surround them. The underwater sounds produced by the blue whale are very low in pitch and are so strong that they can be detected hundreds of miles away. Because the sounds are so low in pitch, they are not heard well at all unless recorded and played back at increased speeds to raise the pitch into the range of better sensitivity of the human ear and of audio equipment. The following sounds we recorded from a blue whale off the coast of Chile. This is also presented at 8 times normal speed.
We know that since the 1960s, blue whale voices have dipped the equivalent of 3 white keys on a piano. They've dropped to that degree. Because of the particular anatomical characteristics of a blue whale, they tend to speak with more bass when they're speaking quietly. It may be simply that as the population has rebounded and there are more whales in the sea, they no longer have to shout to hear one another because there are more of them and they're communicating at a closer proximity. But there is a more worrying explanation, and that is that as the ocean has absorbed more carbon dioxide and become slightly more acidic, it has in fact become a better amplifier for noise as well. It's almost as though we're very slowly turning the volume dial up on the speakers. So all noise is amplified the more acidic the ocean is.
Hobbes takes the idea of the Leviathan from the book of Job. There are 2 quotes that he draws particular attention to, one of which is that the Leviathan is a power that there is nothing equal to on earth, some fearful creature, the sea beast, that no one on earth is able to subdue or enslave. We have to be fearful of this creation. Even though we do sustain it, create it ourselves, We have to be fearful of it because it's the sense that this is something which it is powerless to resist that for Hobbes is part of how we're able to live some kind of ordered and peaceful life. But it was also important to show the Leviathan as king over the proud. And this is a very important message for Hobbes in Leviathan, that human beings being proud, having too high opinion of themselves, of their abilities, of their power, is dangerous for political stability, and that we need to have some humility. We need to be a little bit humble and realise our limitations. Hobbes seems to have had a confidence or a belief that the person or body tasked with this sovereign authority would ultimately have reason to behave quite rationally. He seems to think that the holder of sovereign power will realise that their strength lies in having the strength of its body politic. So there's kind of a confidence there and a faith in reason, which in contemporary times it seems, or can seem, quite naive.
Whalefall describes the process of decay and decline that takes place to a whale's body after death, where it dies in the open ocean. Initially, the whale's body floats on the surface, and while it's there, it's pecked at by scavengers, both aerial scavengers in the form of birds, but also surface living scavengers that come and they sort of strip little bits of flesh from the underside of the carcass. And so you have this odd effect where this dead animal that is puffing up with gases on the surface, just decomposing gases, is quivering slightly because you have all these other animals drawn to peck at it and to pull it apart. After a certain time, there will be enough decay, enough incisions made in the body, that the body will start to fall down through the water column. In the light-filled layers of the sea, there are fish that come to feed from it. There are certain kinds of putrefying gases that build up in the body. But eventually it falls. If it has died in the open ocean, it may fall very, very deep, beyond the range of any whale habitat, beyond the range of a scuba diver. It can fall into the dark, abyssopelagic regions of the ocean. And what happens then is that it is almost as though spring had come to the seafloor, because this whale body represents a massive injection of nutrients, of energy into the system. And it attracts all manner of creatures that live on the seafloor. You get these colourless crabs that are drawn to it. You get animals that look like red streamers or bottled fireworks, and they come and they all feed on the whale carcass. They may have existed in the water column as larva, suspended animation, effectively drifting, waiting in a state of dormancy. We don't know how long, but there are creatures that only feed on deep sea whale carcasses on the seafloor and nowhere else. But eventually what happens is, after all the soft tissue has been removed, after all of the bones have been hollowed out, the entire skeleton will end up draped in a kind of microbial mat, a kind of fluffy bacteria that forms over the bones, kind of tiny little waving fingers. And these will also degrade the bones until there's really nothing left except a kind of dent in the seafloor